Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, we tell you how to hack into Fort Knox. Well, we don't really. We discuss codes and cipher machines with John Alexander and Simon Singh. We test the DNA of a Guardian Science correspondent. Plus,
it's a live transmission of three-dimensional data, real-time, into a virtual world. Hamilton will not overtake you. He theoretically would drive through you. So this you have to simulate. Or if you overtake somebody, and you have to have this game experience, because you will be not as good normally as the drivers.
How the European Space Agency is getting involved in the games industry, taking racing simulators literally to the next level. Again, pen and paper may come in helpful for this week as we set our Codebreaker challenge. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. Let's get our hellos to the Guardian staffers out of the way. Science correspondents Ian Sample and James Randerson are both here, as is Nell Bowes from the Arts Desk. Hello, all.
Hello.
Hello.
You're making it sound like such a chore. We've got to get out of the way.
I just wanted to say, are you all going to miss this pod? This is probably our last recording in here together.
Oh, I'm looking forward to the new one.
You're looking forward to the new one, but can we have a moment of silence for this box of tricks that we've been recording in for so long?
Shoebox.
The shoebox tricks.
Egg box.
We've got two special guests this week, John Alexander and Simon Singh. John is a cipher machine fanatic and has one of the famous Enigma machines in his possession, as well as systems from the USA, Sweden, Switzerland, Russia, as well as the UK. Simon, of course, is an author, journalist, TV producer, and most importantly, no stranger to this pod. His written works include Fermat's Last Theorem and The Codebook, which is all about cryptography. Now, Simon's going to be doing the science bit in just a second, but John has brought in some of the most amazing-looking toys we've ever seen in this pod. John, welcome first. Take us through them.
We have here some really interesting, from my point of view, cipher machines from 1936. There in front of you, Alok, and coming around, we have from the C-36, a C-38, an M-209. Now, these mean nothing to the average person, I understand that, but to collectors of militaria and cipher machines, fanatics like me, they are really juicy things.
Someone listening to this podcast who knows what those codes mean is getting very excited at this point about C-36s and C-38s and all of these things.
Wow.
I'm getting quite excited.
So these are all code machines used in times of war. I mean, people might have heard of the Enigma machine, famously used in the Second World War. Nell's been sort of looking at it and salivating. describe what it looks
like. I'm trying not to get it rusty.
describe what it looks like to us. I mean, from here, it looks a bit like a typewriter.
It is generally described as being like a typewriter, but with no written output. It has a keyboard, a lamp board, and is often known on the continent as a glue lamp machine, a glow lamp. It's got bulbs in it, they light up. It has a plug board on the front, which will switch pairs of characters. And this machine, and variations on it, really found a home with the German military from around 1926.
If you were an officer in the army and you wanted to send a code to someone across the way, how would you start working it?
Well, we need a book with the settings for that time period. I've just opened the inner lid of the machine and we have three rotors visible. We would have had to have chosen which three rotors and in which order to fit those rotors. Then, of course, we have to set them into the correct position. The plugs on the front, operating very silently here, unfortunately, also these switch pairs of characters, and it goes through that plug board twice. It's a very secure cipher machine. It was first broken by the Polish. They did a wonderful job on breaking into this machine from around about 1933, but they were eventually just overcome by the additional complexities being brought in by the German forces. And, well, they were going to be squashed between Germany and Russia. And they made a wonderful gift to the British and the French of a couple of copied Enigma cipher machines. I'm now going to encipher from this current position my first name, John. Here we go. I've pressed J, a T lit up. O lights up, a T again. That's perfectly normal. H has become a Z. And N becomes a Y.
So TTZY is your name encoded
as it's
securely.
Had I returned the wheels now to their original start position and put in TTZY, out would have come JOHN.
Fantastic. Now, that's not the only machine we've got here. There's about four or five smaller things. Each one of these looks about the size of a lunchbox. Right. Tell us how these essentially work. Are they similar in principle?
These are purely mechanical machines, but with a printed output. Anything that prints is very handy in the field. It saves operator time. You can rip off a piece of tape, lick the back, stick it on a message sheet and send it off to the general or to the radio operator. The one in front of you is a C-36 from 1936.
So this is the one that James has been trained how to operate now. Yes. James, tell us what you can see.
It's a lot smaller than the Enigma machine, and it's in a sort of metal case. I guess it's about the size of a small lunchbox. And, you turn this sort of dial on the side to the letters you want, and when you've chosen your letter, so if I'm going to encode ALOC, there's an A, and then I turn the side, and then it's L.
There's a good clunk clunk sound going on.
I'm not sure.
James has broken it.
I might have just broken it. And for some reason,
don't
a K
worry about
is red.
It. I'll accept a cheque for £3,000.
Okay. Ooh. Right. There we go. That might have been ALOC. But anyway, it's got a sort of a small slip of paper which has the cipher on it.
And then the idea, John, is that you would take that code, you'd be able to either read it out over the broadcast or send it
anything
to someone directly.
Anything which goes out over the radio, essentially anybody can listen to.
Yeah.
So you send it out in encrypted format, and hopefully only the guys at the other end with the same machine and the same settings will be able to read it.
John, I mean, presumably they packed off all the soldiers with these or key people with these out into the field. How often were they? How do they sort of tell each other when they're changing the settings, or do they just agree it before they go out and it stays on the same setting for months on end?
This is an overhead, and an important overhead. You have to have a book with the settings or some means of distributing the settings across that particular network. It's not one set for one machine for the whole of Europe, for instance. You might be using the machine within the US Air Force. Well, you might well have different settings to the Army people on the ground. There was a naval version of this too. They would have had their own settings and then possibly other settings so that Army Air Force people could speak to, say, a ground force unit. Mm. So it's not just one net. There's a whole load of nets and settings required.
If someone found that book, they'd have the key to all of this.
You would have to find many books.
Yeah.
But they are eminently breakable in terms of the ciphers.
If you're listening to this podcast now and you're thinking, I must have a look at this, how some of this stuff is working, well, John's kindly made us a video of using the Enigma machines and some of these haggling machines. So go onto the website there in the next couple of days and you can see him describing all of this in gory detail. Simon, let me bring you into this now. John said earlier that these codes that the Enigma produced were pretty good. How good are they, really, compared to codes we've got today? Reading your book, the code book, is that all codes can be broken, basically.
No.
No. All right, good.
But I'll come back to that in a minute. I think you've got to judge each cipher by the era in which it's created. So, you know, if you go back 500 years, you have people just substituting a single letter for a different letter. And that's really easy to break because of, you know, something we may know from school days, which is that every letter's got a certain frequency. So E is very common. In English and German, it's the most common letter. So if you're just simply substituting E for X, I can break your code because I can see X is very popular, therefore X must be E. And that code-breaking achievement was done by the Arabs about 1,000 years ago, Al-Kindi, a mathematician in Baghdad. Incredibly secure at the time, 1,000 years ago, until Al-Kindi broke it. Then the Enigma comes along. What's wonderful about the Enigma is that each letter, if you type in E 100 times, it'll be encrypted as a K, as a J, as a W, lots of different ways. So in its time, it was a huge breakthrough because letters were being encrypted in lots of different ways. I think the Enigma, in a way, could have been unbroken throughout the course of the war. And John may have a different view. But if it had been used properly, it was a very formidable code.
What do you mean by that?
Oh, right. Okay. So the way you could use it improperly, for example, is at the start of the message, you could give the time that you send the message. So it's 1739. Now, if I intercept the message, and I'm a British codebreaker at Bletchley Park, I say, I intercepted this message at 1739. Maybe the first few words are 1739. Once I can get a crowbar into a bit of the message, I can begin to crack the whole thing. If you start off with a very formal greeting to a general, and I know that that's how you always start your messages. If I can tell the direction of a message by doing some kind of triangulation, I know it's come from a weather ship in the North Atlantic. I know that the weather in the North Atlantic at that time of day was foggy and sleet. Great, I know some of the words that might be in the message. That's only a weather message, but if that key network is also for U-boats in the North Atlantic, I can suddenly tap into their communications as well.
So it's the human element in some respects that can let these things down sometimes.
Yeah, you know, very, very much so. I've had a code in the back of my book, 10 codes for people to break. And they got progressively harder and harder and harder. And whoever could break all 10 would win £10,000. So it was a nice prize. Took a whole year for people to break these codes. Now, the final code, I'd actually made a huge blunder in how I'd encoded it. And instead of taking a whole year, it could have been done in half a day. Now, luckily, nobody thought I could be that stupid. And so they all did it the hard way rather than looking. But it was in the end, it turned out to be a really nice demonstration of how the human frailties often undermine the mechanical complexity or the mathematical solidity of a code.
With modern computing, surely it's possible, for example, to completely emulate an Enigma or any of these machines in front of us. So in a sense, machines like this perhaps aren't very good anymore in terms of encoding things, because you could just number crunch through all of the various combinations.
Every machine here on the table, every one of them, to my knowledge, can be emulated in software, and you can walk around with all of these essentially on your laptop. Some of them are available as small applications, and you can carry them on your mobile phone.
Just in case you need to send an Enigma code to your mum.
Which can be done.
In text or something like that. But quick question from James, and then we'll wrap up.
I was just intrigued by something you said earlier on about the Poles broke the Enigma code in the 30s or the 20s, I think you said. And, of course, it's Bletchley Park, that's sort of famous for doing that. And I wondered whether, did they sort of use the information that the Poles had? Did they build on that knowledge and then manage to break the extra stuff? Or were they starting from scratch?
I think it's fair to say that the British have had a fair code-breaking operation going right back to the days of Elizabeth I and Walsingham, etc. Bletchley Park's forerunner had been working on the commercial version of the Enigma machine for some time. The commercial version is simpler and is eminently breakable, use that term again, and was broken very famously by Mavis Beatty and Dilly Knox at Bletchley Park. The Poles got into this machine by really developing a whole new field of mathematics and how to describe this machine and its operation in mathematics, and by starting to design machines to break this machine or to help break it. By that I mean the Polish cyclometer, which is in effect a number of Enigma rotors bolted together. And they can be set spinning away and hopefully will stop at some predetermined output. And maybe, just maybe, that has given you the wheel order and the wheel settings.
There are three rotors in that machine, and the Poles broke the simple Enigma. But those three rotors can be put in six different positions, which makes it six times harder than it might necessarily be if the rotors were in fixed positions. But then during the course of the war, the Germans added extra rotors. So you pick three from five, which makes it maybe 10 times harder. I can't do the numbers in my head straight off, but makes it about 10 times harder. And then it was three from eight. And then the German Navy added a fourth rotor, so now it's four from eight. And it's all sorts of complexities that seem trivial, but actually make the breaking of the Enigma an order of magnitude harder. And that's what Bletchley was doing, was dealing with these additional complexities. Incredible intellectual achievement, but only possible having built on the head start that the Poles had given them.
John, before we go on to the next thing, you're going to set us a quick brain teaser.
The answer lies within this piece of text here. 3 5-letter groups beginning P Papa, F Foxtrot, M Mike, X X-ray, O Oscar, Juliet, Foxtrot, Mike, Sierra, Tango, Bravo, Quebec, Zulu, Golf, Tango.
Last week, Nell did amazingly well on the maths puzzle, so we're going to have to expect you to finish sorting this out by the end. Or Simon, in fact, because you're a code expert. Thanks very much to both of you.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Now, last week, we heard from the president of Virgin Galactic. Also speaking at the annual Appleton Space Conference at Harwell was Frank Salzgeber, who is head of technology transfer for the European Space Agency. James Randerson collared him for a quick chat. First, he asked him why space exploration was still justified.
Christoph Columbus was growing up in Genova, and the people were too tight, therefore he went to Spain. That was the question, why the UK built ships to explore the world. Well, Europeans are explorers, and as I said, society stops exploring, stops progressing. It's part of our... If the people say, oh, we landed on the continent called America, why we should go east? Why? Why we should build a railway? It's part of our society. You have to do a certain investment. Exploration and science, it comes together. Therefore, it's just a part. And if you see the money spent in space, it's so small like other projects. We learn more. Yeah. When the guys were inventing the microscope, the people said, why we need that? It's enough. You have to always go a step further.
If someone would say to you, okay then, in terms of this technology transfer advantages back here on Earth, what are the top three things that have come out of European space exploration that you could name?
I would say, you know, it's also European, because I would say we have a lot of stuff in health. We see a lot of stuff in safety, yeah? Starting, as I said, from the airbag ABS system. Composite lightweight structure was started in space, then in aviation, and now it goes to automotive. So it's sometimes even a life cycle. So I would say energy efficiency, look to the solar cells. Space was doing the foundation. Now they have split it. Now the lead marketing is not space anymore. It will come back again to space. So we have to see the innovation is really a circle.
He also discussed a unique application for a Formula One computer game, where you can use live 3D data to take part in real races as they happen.
They're testing it since 1 year already on racetracks, and they will have demo, I think, beginning of next year, where you yourself hopefully log in on the web, it will be a web application, and you will test yourself against one driver. But there really the push comes from Asia. I know that Singapore, they will build a new race course near the airport. And there, even the Ministry of Economic Affairs is aware of this project and is really into that. He wants that this racetrack is also enabled to use these technologies. So you need antennas, you need transceivers and so on. But if you see, this technology can be used for other things too. It's not only, it can be sport, but of course military. This is quite interesting, combat training. Mm-hmm. So it's a live transmission of three-dimensional data, real-time, into a virtual world.
How long do you think it's going to be before this company gets the technology right? It does sound like there's still quite a lot to do.
Yeah, I would say that the first test they will have at the beginning of the next year. And I would say within another 12 months, it should be implemented in a game which you can buy off the shelf. The transmission of the signal is not a problem. Now what you have is a little bit artificial intelligence, because you can't through... if Hamilton will not overtake you, he theoretically would drive through you. So this you have to simulate. Okay. Or if you overtake somebody, and you have to have this game experience, because you will be not as good normally as the drivers. So you have to match really the virtual and the real world. And this intelligent artificial, this is the problem. This is really a problem.
So I can imagine... you know, buying the game in the future and having, you know, a whole load of historical Grand Prix that you can join in on.
Something,
you know,
like
the last
that.
Race
it,
of
it
the
will
season.
Be, it must be web-based, but as, this is what we hear. Because then you say, if you have to go out with the kids, you know, in the afternoon when the Formula One is racing or the Grand Prix or whatever, and you don't have time, in the evening the kids are in bed, you upload your game and play it then. And there, of course, there's more possibility than only games. Could be the same for football, could be for everything.
That was Frank Salzgeber, who's head of technology transfer for the European Space Agency. Now for a look at some of the science stories around this week, here's Ian and Nell with the News Jam.
News Jam.
We now have the most accurate measurements yet of the giant black hole that sits at the centre of our galaxy. Researchers from the Max Planck Institute for Extraterrestrial Physics used two telescopes operated in Chile to watch stars as they circled the centre of the Milky Way. The 16-year study proves the existence of the black hole beyond doubt.
A group of the world's leading scientists has asked the UN to establish a network to look for asteroids on a collision course with Earth. The Space Guard system would also be responsible for deploying spacecraft that could destroy or deflect incoming objects. It would cost £68 million a year.
And finally, dogs know when they've been treated unfairly. How do we know? Well, they refuse to play ball. The animals stopped cooperating with researchers and began to show signs of distress if they were not offered the same tasty rewards given to other dogs. Affronted canines refused to offer their paws when invited to and began scratching and yawning, indicating their stress levels were rising. This sense of justice could be crucial for social animals and may have played a role in the evolution of cooperation.
Nell and Ian, thank you both. Now, these are all excellent stories, and I heartily recommend you read Ian's blog on what's inside a black hole to get that first one explained. But we're going to talk about something a bit different. The one we're going to talk about this week is was on the website, titled The Day I Had My Genes Tested by James Randerson. James, you've laid your genetic code bare to the world. Take us through the process. What did you do?
There are various companies that you can use to do this, some of which are sort of based on the internet, some of which are a bit more upmarket, and you get a consultation in Harley Street. We went for one of them called Genetic Health, and you send in, they send you some swabs, you move them around inside your mouth to pick up some cells, and you send them back to them. And they test 42 different genes for various things, from Alzheimer's to cancer, and then they give you this kind of report on your genetic makeup, or that rather small part of your genetic makeup, and then you go for a consultation where you sit in a swanky office with their doctor, and he tells you what it's all about.
What was the report on the Randerson front?
In one sense, it's sort of good news in that pretty much everything I was at low risk for. I mean, the one of the genes that there is quite a good evidence base for a link with Alzheimer's is ApoE, and I was very much in the kind of medium risk bracket in that I've got the genetic type that about 60% of the population have got, and so that was kind of reassuring. But the rest of it was a mishmash of things for sort of heart disease and cancer, etc. And when I sort of took my report to five different genetic experts who have done a lot of the studies that have kind of come up with these genes, I mean, they were not very impressed in that they thought that the company itself wasn't really testing the genes that we know are involved. And so the genes that they looked at were kind of irrelevant, they said. You know, I don't know whether that means I should be a bit more worried, since on the face of it, the news was good. But I think the problem here is that it's still early days with this field. You know, I mean, obviously, we had the Human Genome Project completing in 2000, and since then, there's been lots of effort to try and work out which genes are linked to which diseases. Now, there are some like BRCA1 and BRCA2, which have a very strong link with disease, breast cancer and ovarian cancer. In those cases, you know, if you have the particular variants, then you're almost certain to get breast cancer. But most genes aren't like that. Most of the time, they confer a slight increase in risk, and they interact with other genes in complex ways. And you know, obviously, your lifestyle and your environment, whether you smoke, how much exercise you do, all of that makes a difference. And so it's easy, I think, to get a kind of simplistic message. I mean, actually, to be fair, this company gives you a consultation to kind of help you interpret your results. But other companies just give you a report, which you get in the post. And you can imagine people getting rather worried about the potential of getting certain diseases and maybe being a little bit reckless with respect to other diseases because they think they're not at risk. But actually, you know, whether you smoke and how you live your life is also very important.
You can read James's story at guardian.co.uk/science. And just before we finish this section, just to let you know that our coverage of the UN Climate Change Summit in Poznan has been ably done by environment correspondent David Adam. He's been there all week. For the latest from that, go to guardian.co.uk/environment.
Science Weekly.
Let's now take a look at some of the feedback we've been having on the blogs and Facebook wall after last week's maths quiz podcasts.
So Bandaged Hand in Hand says, can someone explain to me why the answer to the second problem can't be 3? 12 minutes later, he or she posts, never mind, I get it now.
Andy Mitchell from Webster Central Schools wrote, thanks for giving maths another week in the pod. I was splicing the bit about a negative times a negative to share with my 7th graders and found that the file was 3 minutes 14.1 seconds long. That's pi, by the way. Coincidence?
And producer Andy tried to be clever by posting back, if you play the podcast backwards, it's the solution to the Hodge conjecture. I don't get that. Finally,
Gyan Mintwu says that the maths, as you British say, quiz was really fun. I got the second and really should have gotten the third. My American accent should be better. Except I sadly couldn't remember, once again, how to formalise unless. Does anyone know? Should A unless B be formalised as if B then A? Which I think would have corrected my answer. And I think no.
He is actually Canadian.
Is he Canadian?
I think
I'm
he
so
might
sorry,
be.
Kian.
I think he might be, yeah.
Try if not B, then A. That should work.
Either join our Facebook group and post a comment on the wall or leave something on the blog. That's at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Back now to our studio guests, John Alexander and Simon Singh. John set as a teaser at the beginning of the show, and I'm just going to quickly read it out again. And I'm not going to do the international alphabet here, but I'm just going to read them out. PF. MXO JFMST BQZGT. Now, did anyone in the pod work this out? James, I saw you scribbling stuff. What did you come up with?
Well, there was a bit after that in the script that said, think of Caesar going backwards. So I was writing Caesar backwards and I was writing going backwards. None of that really helped. Yeah, no, I was pretty at a loss.
Not a clue. I was thinking about Et tu, Brute, and trying to work out if there are any famous quotes.
Simon, you must have worked this out.
Caesar's associated with the shift, the shifting of letters to and fro, although he didn't invent it, but he wrote about it.
So, John, give us the answer.
It's Bletchley Park. Basically,
really?
It's a Caesar cipher. It's a standard, easy shift. I just did it backwards.
I have to say, I'm still slightly lost. So what are the letters of five groups?
It doesn't matter about the groups.
If you write those out, reverse them,
and
then apply a standard Caesar shift, and if you apply that, you should reveal Bletchley Park.
I mean, John, you're going to be talking about codes and cipher machines as part of a lecture series at Bletchley Park. I mean, it was one of the most important places during the war for code breaking, as we've intimated before. Can you give us a sense of what they were up to there, kind of how much effort was going on over there?
Almost 10,000 people working on codes and ciphers, breaking them to reveal what the enemy was up to. If you know what your opponent is going to be doing over the next 2 or 3 days, that gives you a huge advantage. If we're talking about output from the German Lorenz machine, it's not merely what their intentions are for the next 2 or 3 days, but their intentions possibly for the next 2, 3, 4, 6 months.
So thousands and thousands of technicians and sort of engineers and things. Simon, how important was Bletchley Park for sort of development of code science, if you like? Because, I mean, there was a real brains trust of people sitting there being boffins and things.
Prior to Bletchley, you'd have had linguists and classicists and people with a fascination of language trying to break codes. Whereas Bletchley, following the model created by the Poles, the model there was to bring in mathematicians, engineers, puzzle solvers, chess players, and also to mechanise decryption. John already mentioned that the Polish mechanical code-breaking machines, well, Bletchley did the same, but it invented these things called bombs, which would sort of reverse-engineered enigmas for cracking the enigma. The Colossus, which was, depending on how you define a computer, the first computer to, again, crack one of the German codes, the Lorenz. So it really took code-breaking into a new era in the same way that enigma had taken code-making into a new era. The machines used in the Second World War were still used for decades after. These mechanical machines were still used. Now, the British knew that they were easy to break, but nobody else did. So the British wanted to keep that secret. In fact, I think it's true to say that the British collected lots of German Enigma machines as they swept through Europe, brought them back to London, and then would ring up countries like Australia and Canada and say, look, we've got these wonderful German Enigma machines. The Germans swear by them. They're unbreakable. Why don't you have one? Have two. Have as many as you like. Seemed like a very generous gesture at the time, but in fact, it just meant they could eavesdrop for years and years.
There's a big sea change at Bletchley with who the codebreakers are. Who are the codebreakers now?
Oh, very, very much mathematicians. In fact, the biggest employer of mathematicians in the world is the American codebreaking establishment, the NSA, the National Security Agency. It's a highly mathematical field, both code making and code breaking. And code breaking is a tricky one because today's codes, actually coming back to the point you made at the very beginning, you said all codes can be broken. Today's codes, we live in a golden era of code making. The codes that we can use for free, you know, you can buy them on the high street, you can download them for free. I can send you an email. Nobody else in the world, using all the computer power in the world, running it for a billion years, would be able to crack our codes. That's how strong they are. They're effectively unbreakable. And what the code breakers therefore have to do is to try and pick up on the human error that sometimes gets made, or do things like traffic analysis. If I've got no idea what you're emailing, at least I know when you're emailing and who you're emailing to, and maybe I can glean some information out of that. Highly, highly mathematical pursuit.
Okay, we'll leave that there. Thank you to both our guests, Simon and John. Don't forget to add your voice to the debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Chah. Thanks for listening.